Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner, and of course, welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show. And Soundbites, our weekly look at food and farming, energy, and the environment. And we're going to talk in this hour about energy systems and the environment and the future, both that are built around the state of Maryland, but also around the country and the world, and what we can expect over these next 4 years, what the issues are that we're facing. I have two women now we're about to have a conversation with who know a great deal and are serious activists and scholars. Janet Redman, who is now U.S. Policy Director with Oil Change International and Associate Fellow with the Climate Change Policy at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Daphne Weisham, who is Director of Climate and Energy Program Center for Sustainable Economy. And both used to be at IPS when they first came here with us. And Janet and Daphne, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be back. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you all here. So let's begin here. You both have been following what's been happening at Standing Rock. Let me just start there because it leads us into other things. And it was interesting. Robert Kennedy made the comment that he thought that what happened at Standing Rock was a kind of a game changer in changing the direction of where the environmental movement might go. And I wonder what your thoughts on that are as this unfolds, winding down in one sense, but picking up in another, because they may have doing the study, but it doesn't change. It will not stop. It doesn't seem to be, it will stop the pipeline itself. But so it's kind of a mixed thing. So how do you see that, Daphne?
Well, I think what you're right that the Standing Rock protest has been a game changer in many ways. First of all, it's the first time in my memory when we've had not just Native Americans from the Sioux Reservation, but indigenous people from all over the Americas coming together and converging on a struggle like this to protect the water in Lake Oahe and also to really stand up to the oil industry. And they are leading. We are following their lead, we being, you know, the non-Native people who support their struggle. And so that's a really, I think that's a very important turning point in the environmental movement where we're taking the lead from our Native allies. It's also a game changer just in the sense that what we're probably going to see with this EIS is a continuation of some delays that may result in the investors in the pipeline pulling out once their contract obligations come to a close, which my understanding is in January. So we could see people withdrawing their support in addition to the Norwegians who've already withdrawn. Norwegian banks have withdrawn from their investment in this pipeline. That could accelerate. On the other hand, having Trump in office after January 20th could be another game changer because he's both heavily invested personally and is
right.
Clearly appointing officials that support the oil industry up and down the list.
Janet, you have some extra thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Daphne nailed it there. I think the show of frontline leadership and the climate community moving in behind frontline leadership has really learned the lesson that this is the wave of the future. And in fact, looking at the different groups across the political spectrum who have their agendas under attack or will have their agendas under attack by a Trump administration and this next Congress, I think folks have really figured out that it's time to build alliances where those who are most impacted are taking the lead. And I think environment and climate activists are figuring that out. But certainly, looking at the promises that Trump has made in terms of his climate agenda, we should be celebrating this victory, but certainly recognizing that there is a long, long slog ahead. Besides promising to move forward with Dakota Access, of course, Trump has promised to move forward with Keystone, revisit that decision. And then has basically written down the list of wins that Obama had put in place and that the truly people have put in place during Obama's tenure and start crossing them off his list. So, for example, pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, lifting a coal lease moratorium on public lands, and then expanding fossil fuel, oil, and gas leasing on public lands, killing the Clean Power Plan, revisiting renewable fuel standards and federal fuel economy standards, CAFE standards, are just a couple of the things that he has articulated both on the campaign trail in his first 100 days, and that the people who he's beginning to appoint or talking to for key positions have articulated as priorities for their, if they were in fact to be heading some of the most important pieces of our federal government, including, of course, the EPA and the Department of Interior that controls oil and gas on public lands.
So let me pick up on where you just took us with that, Janet, and just look at this incoming administration and what we think this all portends for us over the next 4 years in terms of what we can talk in a moment about what responses from people who are struggling for a clean environment and different energy policy, but what this means from the perspective of Trump administration, what they will do, what can we look to see happening? What are the danger signs for you that we really kind of have to articulate and understand that we're going to have to face and kind of struggle with? Daphne?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we're looking at a worst-case scenario on so many different levels. And I'm going to start with the bad news first, because I do think we have to face up to just how bad it is, you know, that we have Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is going to be heading up the EPA. Now, this is a man who has gone after every air pollutant regulation, is a complete, you know, he's doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industry. There's no question. We've also heard that Trump is going to withdraw from the Paris Accord, which, of course, that's less easy to do than is withdrawing from the UN climate negotiations altogether, which is something that he could do fairly quickly, whereas the Paris Agreement will remain in force for another 4 years. The other thing that's really a worst case scenario...
I'm sorry, Daphne, I'm only interrupting. I want to make sure I understand, our listeners understand. You're saying that Trump cannot withdraw from the Paris Agreement?
The way it's set up, the Paris Accord, is that it's an agreement that's in place for 4 years, and it can be, the Trump administration could theoretically withdraw from it after 4 years, assuming they get reelected. However, in the interim, and you'd have to talk to a lawyer about this who would understand the nuances here, but my understanding is that we could defund our participation in the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and essentially say that we're not going to participate as a member of the UNFCCC in any of the negotiations moving forward.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to be clear. Go ahead.
The other, you know, the stark reality that's really a worst-case scenario is what's happening in the environment, in terms of sea level rise, in terms of glacial melting, the Greenland ice sheet is very unstable. The Antarctic ice sheet is prone to very rapid melt. When I was in Marrakesh, State Department Secretary John Kerry had just returned from Antarctica, and he told us that the Pine Island Glacier, which is a piece of Antarctica, when it goes, and it's moving very fast, that would result in 5 feet of sea level rise, just that one glacier. And that could happen as soon as mid-century or by the end of the century. So we have, you know, certain physical realities that we have to face up to. Properties that are at sea level, countries that are at sea level, small island nations, are going to be going underwater regardless of what Trump or anybody does. So the question is, will we use the next 4 years with alternative strategies that don't involve the federal government in the U.S., and what will those be? And I think there is some room for hope, but that would take another perhaps another show to get into, but I do think that there is room for hope.
And Janet?
Yeah, I just want to actually, just to pick up on a piece of, I think Daphne's right, there are some concerning timelines with the Paris Agreement. It may take, you know, he could signal his intention to not to participate in the Paris Agreement, and indeed when this gets renewed, then the U.S. could potentially not be involved in it and could leave the UNFCCC, the UN Framework Convention, after a year. But I think what's most pressing and what's most, you know, what's easiest for him to do is just to not do anything. That's the problem with the Paris Agreement, was in fact there is no binding there's no binding action that has to take place except for what you promise as a country. And so, in fact, he could just not do the things that were promised. He could not implement the Clean Power Plan. He could not implement fuel standards. He could just not take action, and that's very clearly what he's planning to do. I think when you asked about danger signs, or my mind, red flags, I think two things pop up, which we're seeing over and over again in the people he's planning to staff the federal government with, and that's climate denialism, which is
right.
Incredibly right. worrying, and a basic idea that science shouldn't count, and financing from the fossil fuel sector. So certainly, Attorney General Scott Pruitt is a huge concern and should have us all being very nervous and pushing back on that. But then also Secretary of State nominee that Trump is talking about, Rex Tillerman, who's the CEO of ExxonMobil and has built his entire career, not denying climate change necessarily, but lying about what Exxon knew was going to be the impact of pulling oil out of the ground and burning it. And so, in fact, putting the planet at risk, putting the American public at risk for decades while lying about it to the public for his own profits. And then, of course, the SEC has been investigating that company now for the way it values its assets. As oil prices plunge, as climate regulations have been rolling out, basically the people that Trump is thinking about putting into key positions are not champions not only of the environment, but not champions of the American public.
So I know it's hard not to sound dire.
Pretty dire.
Right?
Pretty dire.
It really is. I mean, this is probably one of the most corporate-laden from the fossil fuel industry and climate denier cabinet and major federal appointments we've ever seen. We've seen in decades and decades and decades. And so it really is. So were you about to say something, Daphne? I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you?
No. I was just going to say that, in Marrakesh, when people found out that Trump was indeed, you know, there was shock and denial. And then, you know, as it began to occur to people that this was actually happening, the rest of the world came together very quickly and said, you know, it really doesn't, on some level, we're going to do this no matter what. There were whisperings that I heard of the U.S. effectively passing the baton to China and saying, okay, now it's your turn to lead the world because the next 4 years we're not going to see anything happening in the U.S. The other thing to think about is, you know, that's relatively positive is that there is a certain momentum both at the state level and at the city level. And this is where I see a lot of room for hope. Cities around the world are moving forward and sharing success stories with each other on how best to both adapt to climate change and to move rapidly towards the clean energy alternatives. And this is not an insignificant amount of, you know, people and global emissions that these cities represent. The C40 cities are now over 80 cities that are, major cities like Hong Kong and Paris and Buenos Aires and others that are really, and Mexico City, that are moving forward regardless of what their national governments do. And Portland, in fact, where I'm living now, is about to pass the nation's first ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure. That's happening tomorrow.
What does that mean?
And we hear it's going to be a unanimous vote. Well, you know, what's been happening at Standing Rock, people have been following this one pipeline, which is obviously a very important struggle, but what people forget is that we're under siege with one proposal after another out here on the West Coast. All of that oil is flowing from the Bakken and from the tar sands to ports largely headed towards Asia. And so there's one fossil fuel export terminal after another being proposed all up and down the West Coast. And so Portland, by saying we will not build any new fossil fuel export infrastructure, is basically sending a message to the Bakken and to the tar sands that they're not going to roll over anymore and just allow this kind of crazy infrastructure to be built in the face of climate chaos. We've got over 30 elected officials up and down the West Coast that are pledging to do the same, and it's growing by the day. So there is pushback happening at the city level, and we're hoping soon at the state level against a lot of this infrastructure that's being proposed.
And I do think there's a positive. I think those are exactly the right places where we should look for hope. And then, you know, even in the market, we are seeing that renewable energy is growing faster than fossil fuels, even though fossil fuels benefit from about $20 billion of government handouts and giveaways every year. So really, the cost of renewable energy, the competitiveness of renewable energy, is sending a message to investors who I think are an important constituency and in many ways read the writing on the wall, maybe not because they're virtuous, but because it impacts their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as we've talked about, people power is clearly a place to look for hope and to look for change. And I think since the election, we've seen an incredible outpouring of activism, of solidarity, of thinking about how a variety of struggles need to be linked together in order to make sure that more broadly, civil society isn't rolled over. But in particular, climate change has been a rallying cry for those on the left who perhaps weren't even excited about a Clinton presidency, but are excited about and are dedicated to and are passionate about protecting the planet and protecting the health of communities here in the United States and the safety of people everywhere. So that, I think, is an incredibly hopeful sign.
I mean... You, some of the things you've been writing that I was looking at, Janet. I mean, you talked about his ability to scrap. We're talking about Trump's ability to scrap, as you talked about the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan that you did in Foreign Policy and Focus, and that might mean, and what the response could be.
Certainly, and I think again, this is Daphne pointed this out. A part of what was, I mean, perhaps now in retrospect, may have been an interesting aspect of the Clean Power Plan was that instead of a single regulation from the EPA, it was a framework that every state was then enabled to kind of fill the details in their own particular way based on their own situations. And so, while a number of states were suing the EPA about the Clean Power Plan, a number of states said, we will voluntarily go forward and we will voluntarily think about how we're shifting from dirtier energy to cleaner energy. Certainly there are still flaws in that. It relies heavily on natural gas. There are opportunities for carbon trading and market mechanisms that would undermine the integrity of a shift to cleaner energy. But I think what it means is that Trump can certainly attempt to... kill off regulation, but it's not going to happen as quickly as he promises, because he doesn't actually have a magic wand, which I assume he'll figure out once he realizes what governing means, which I think will be a surprise to him, and maybe it already has been as he's learning more and more. But it will take time to undo some of these pieces, and that's not to say this is that's okay, because this is an urgent issue, and I think what's scaring many of us is that time is not on our side on the climate issue,
right.
But it hasn't been for quite some time, I suppose. And I think it is strengthening the backbone of many at the local and state level to do what's right, what's reasonable, what's good for consumers, energy consumers, what's good for residents. And so I think we will see some really interesting workarounds, and we will certainly see some defense and pushback around dismantling of climate and clean energy policy as well.
And just for perspective, I mean, Daphne, you posted an article that I read about President Obama's legacy, which I think the perspective is important. You posted an article from The Guardian about the $34 billion from the Import-Export Bank that the U.S. Mm-hmm. has invested in dirty fuel export-import banks, mm-hmm. across the globe. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an interesting perspective here. As much as he's done to push changes here in the country, which maybe not as far as we wanted them to go, but that there's another legacy as well.
Exactly, and that's actually the legacy that I've been, and Janet and others have been working on for several decades now, but which is taking on all the multilateral development banks and the export credit agencies, all of this money that's being funneled out the door with taxpayer backing and assistance and subsidies that is acting essentially just like another private bank and going after coal-fired power plants in India and oil and gas pipelines in Africa in the name of poverty alleviation and sustainable development. And we've been saying since the late 1990s that the U.S. must lead these multilateral development banks and export credit agencies and get them out of this stuff, that it's actually bad for the poor. It's not benefiting the poor. It's benefiting the corporations, clearly. We got some movement under Obama where he did call on the World Bank and the Export-Import Bank to get out of coal. And, of course, he did a lot of other things, like push for, I think one of his biggest achievements was pushing for the agreement in Kigali to phase out HFCs, which will slow down global warming by at least a half a degree, but that's another topic. He hasn't done enough with these multilateral development banks and export credit agencies, but it's not entirely, in his court. These development banks are accountable to other governments as well, and Germany has called on all of them to get out of fossil fuels and coal in particular. So we're seeing some movement, but boy, has it taken a long time to get what little movement we've gotten.
So, on the other side of this thing, we'll see who gets appointed, more of this all moves, and the appointments so far really do indicate that Trump, will be, and his administration with Pence, will be kind of pushing a really retrograde kind of policy around climate change, and EPA may back off on all kinds of things that they are involved in now, to from the Chesapeake Bay to all parts of the country, in terms of ensuring regulation and cleaning up the environment. I mean, we know that will be happening, but so on the activist side, I'm curious where you see the growth in the movement and what effect that movement could have in the face of this of the administration and the House and Senate being where it will be. Janet? I'm fine. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
sorry. I'll jump in and then I'll pass it over to Daphne. I mean, I think one of the frontline battles, and folks were declaring this in a sense, no matter who was elected in this most recent presidential election, is of course around natural gas and the pipelines for natural gas in particular, pipelines for oil as well. But I think natural gas has kind of emerged as a real space where many people have said this is the kind of infrastructure we absolutely don't need and don't want, and pipelines in general. LNG export, I think, is a piece of that infrastructure battle. So I feel like infrastructure writ large is a place where there are physical locations on the ground that run through communities where people are defending their property, where people are defending their water, people are defending their communities, and that's going to be a major kind of front line of activism. I think the other space is a bit more esoteric. It's kind of, it counters this, I think, really unfortunate idea that in part Trump won some hearts and minds on, which is the idea that we can bring back, we can grow the economy by bringing back fossil fuel industry jobs, in particular coal jobs. What we know is, of course, the coal industry has been slowly but surely dying, not largely because of regulation, but because of the falling price of natural gas, so losing competitiveness, lower demand for coal, and increased automation. There just aren't people doing those jobs anymore. There are machines doing those jobs. So his promises are ring incredibly hollow if you look at the economics of it and if you just look at the way the market is shifting. But even on oil and gas, if we were to remove the public handouts that we give to the oil and gas industries, we would not see the kinds of jobs in those industries that are there right now. And so if we shift that money to clean energy, which is what we know the future holds, we would actually get more jobs per dollar. So the only way we lose jobs in that sector is if we pull out those subsidies and just make a big bonfire on the beach and burn that money. If we move that money to different job sectors in the renewable energy and energy efficiency sectors, we actually grow jobs. So I think we're going to see a lot of activity in this universe that people are calling transition or just transition, where people are saying we need to shift the economy, but we need to do it in a way that's good for communities and for workers, so that no one no one is left behind. No one feels like that segment of Americans who voted for Trump because they felt like no one was listening to them. That's going to be an important space also for activism.
So, when you definitely look at what happened, and you described what happened in Portland. So I wonder where you think the kind of activism will take this, feeding on what Janet was just saying, where the activism will take hold in place and what effect it can really have in the next 4 years.
You know, one thing that has become clearer to me with time in working on this issue, and maybe it's just me, but I think we're beginning to realize as a people that we are the people we've been waiting for. I know that's a cliche, but D.C. has never led on climate change. It's always been up to us to push them. I mean, you think about the Keystone XL fight where we surrounded the White House and we got arrested. You think about Standing Rock and how people have been out there in the bitter cold and we managed to get a victory just in the last few days. You think about the Arctic and we participated in the blockade of the Shell icebreaker here in Portland, Oregon. And then within weeks of that, Shell pulled out of the Arctic and Obama said the Arctic was off limits for future drilling. You know, this is what happens when the people lead. And I'm convinced that we're beginning to finally feel our power in this arena. And we're also beginning to recognize that the frontline groups like the Native Americans are our strongest allies because they're speaking with such integrity and nonviolence, and that is the way forward. That combined with the happy circumstance that the price of solar is now cheaper than oil and gas may just save us. But boy, we do not have time. We've got to be ramping up even faster our activism over the next 4 years than we've ever seen it before, because we are out of time and we've got to bend that curve of greenhouse gas emissions down like yesterday.
And I think it's really important to say that here, in rounding this up, is Janet, is that it wasn't an easy task under President Obama. You've now seen Trudeau in Canada opening up pipelines there. That the power of oil, the power of the money invested in those companies, now gas, that they invest in as well, is huge. And so Trump can exacerbate it by who he puts in office and even kind of play that game even further for big oil and the rest. But I mean, their power is immense, and I hear what you both are saying, but it's going to take like a major, major push. This could be the catalyst to do it, as Daphne was saying, but not to be negative about it, but just kind of being realistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, you're right, and we have seen that borne out over history. I mean, we've seen the influence of the fossil industry, you know, really for more than 100 years here in the United States. We've been subsidizing them for more than 100 years here in the U.S. with our own tax dollars. And yes, Democrats and Republicans both benefit from contributions from the fossil fuel industry. So we should not fool ourselves that Trump is the first person to be in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. I think what is frightening, of course, is that he's so open to their message, and he is appointing people who are not just shills for the fossil fuel industry, but are literally the CEOs of fossil fuel companies. But I think that shouldn't dissuade us. I think we are seeing a recognition across the board in the United States, both Democrats, Republicans. It's a bit generational. Young people are concerned about climate change, period. And even if you don't, I think for folks that don't necessarily think about keeping fossil fuel in the ground first, there are people who are demanding new forms of clean energy for public health reasons, for reasons of innovation. I don't think we're going to... It's completely fair to say this monster is no weaker than it has been in the past. I think what's stronger is the number of people who understand the role of the fossil fuel industry in hurting our environment and hurting people's families' actual health, and the promises that the CEOs of fossil fuel industries have made in the past that say, you know, without us, you don't have jobs. Without us, you don't have energy. You don't have, the lights don't turn on. Your energy is more expensive. It's been shown again and again that, in fact, the CEOs of the fossil fuel industry are not on our side. They're happy to dump workers as soon as their profits start constricting. They're happy to dump in our rivers and in the atmosphere, which hurts us. They don't have our back, and in fact, we can grow the economy. We can grow jobs in a much healthier way, faster, with clean energy jobs and clean jobs in general, and in a variety of sectors. So while I think we're up against a formidable foe, at the same time, I think we've got more energy, more arguments, more of the science and more of the evidence that we would be better off as a people if we were to band together, which I think we're seeing at Standing Rock, and say no to these fossil fuel industries, not just because of climate, but because of the health of our families, because of the health of workers, because of the future that we all want for ourselves, for our kids, for our grandkids. And that just can't happen if we let the fossil fuel industry run amok.
I agree, Jen. I think you know, definitely as we close this out now, that we will, I think, see a surge in activism that can have an effect. The struggle is going to be tough, but it can have an effect. And I think that...
Absolutely.
You know, and I was thinking about what she said about Portland, and we're going to be focusing a lot in this program in the next coming months on what cities are doing here in the United States and across the globe as kind of the front line of all of that, as you've shown has happened in Portland.
Yeah, and you know, I think Trudeau is in for a big surprise with his pipelines. And I mean, I don't know if it's a surprise, but he's going to get a lot of pushback. The Native people and the First Nations people are beginning to really feel their power, and you know, treaty rights and some of the legal tools that they can use to enforce those treaty rights have resulted in lots of projects being killed out here in the Pacific Northwest. So. Who knows how that will unfold, but I suspect we'll be seeing Standing Rocks over and over again up in Canada.
Well, I really appreciate the two of you taking all this time with us today, and I look forward to really talking to you a great deal more in the coming year, both of you. You just heard Daphne Weisham, who is Director of Climate and Energy Program Center for Sustainable Economy, and Janet Redmond, U.S. Policy Director for Oil Change International. Good to have you both with us. Really was good to have you both with us. Great conversation. Sobering, but
thank you.
But as we say, it's awoke. And it's good to have you both here. And I want you all to stay tuned now, because when we come back, Arjun Makhijani will be with us to talk about the economy of changing our fossil fuel industry into clean energy, and his thoughts on that and all his work over the years. And so we'll be right back with all that. And Janet and Daphne, once again, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. I want you to welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and, of course, Soundbites. It's Thursday, which means it's our weekly look at food and our future and the environment and energy. And we have with us today Dr. Arjun Makhijani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, authored the book Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy, and has been in this business for a long time. And Arjun, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Well, thank you, Mark. I'm really happy to be on your show.
So let me begin, given the world we're in now politically, to kind of, I really want to explore the viability of an alternative energy future and what that would mean, because many people say it would be much too expensive to switch from oil and gas and coal even to this new energy systems. And so let me just begin there in a very broad sense about the economic viability of it all.
Well, I've just finished a four-year look at Maryland, which is not the most exuberant state for renewable energy resources. But, you know, California, Arizona, they're much better situated than us. Even North Dakota and South Dakota have so much wind energy, Wyoming. So even though we're not the best endowed state, we have far more solar and wind resources than we could possibly need, even with a much larger economy. Our resources are mainly solar on land, on rooftops, on brownfields, and so on, and offshore wind. Of course, we're part of a larger electric grid, and we can also import wind energy from other parts of the eastern United States. I concluded after 4 years of work looking at Maryland, which is on the more costly side than, say, Arizona or California, that it would be more economical to have an efficient renewable system in the United States over the next 30, 35 years compared to what we call business as usual, going on using fossil fuels and nuclear power into the indefinite future. Now, I say this without regard to the terrible costs of climate disruption that are already beginning to appear. So those would be, in effect, free benefits that we could get if we are courageous enough to set course right now.
What would it mean for us to be courageous enough? I mean, what's the brass tacks of that? If you actually had the power to advise, let's start locally for a moment, the new gubernatorial administration, what would that mean? What would it look like? How would you get there?
Well, what it means is that you have to give business certainty to investors that you're going to pursue a renewable and efficient system. And since solar and wind are variable, that we are going to pursue storage, demand response, and other technical solutions that are required to make such a system reliable. For example, we use dishwashers and whenever we want, or water heaters whenever, you know, take a shower, or the electricity in the heater will come on.
Right.
But there are ways of using these resources that can make them more compatible with variable wind and solar and make it cheaper for us to heat water or use our dishwashers and clothes washers. That requires technical implementation of technologies, which are collectively called the smart grid. Smart grid will require a lot of investment, not more investment than business as usual, but very different investment. That'll pay off over 20, 30 years. No one is going to invest if you vary from year to year. Today you have, you know, a wind energy goal 2 years hence, and then 2 years later you change your mind. It will not work that way. So that's what I mean by being bold. We have to have the guts to set forth, as Germany has done, as Denmark has done, and in the United States, there are two very different political examples, California and Texas.
Okay.
They are doing it.
What do you mean they're doing it?
Well, California has formally set very high goals for greenhouse gas reductions and renewable energy and efficiency for zero emission, zero net energy houses and buildings and so on. Texas set sort of weak goals some years back and soon surpassed them. It doesn't really have formal renewable energy goals, but Texas has far more wind energy than any other state. And its projections to add wind and add solar energy, I think, are at least as high as any other state. So they are going to achieve a low-carbon energy system without regulations because it's much more economical to do it. But they have a grid operator, the Lone Star Grid, ERCOT, which has enabled the investments in the transmission systems that enable solar and wind energy to be brought to market, you know, from West Texas and the Panhandle, for instance, to the central Texas area, Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, Houston.
So let me come back to something you said here, and I'm really interested in this question of how you make those changes and what those investments really mean. When you talked about developing a system of storage
demand response.
Yeah, demand response. I don't quite understand what you mean when you say that, and I'm sure our listeners don't, what it means to invest in that. Who does the investment? What would it cost? And what would the return be?
Well, so far as the distribution utilities, the utilities that today own the wires, like Baltimore Gas and Electric, like Pepco and so on, they are the ones that would make a very large portion of the investment in the distribution system. It could be third parties. It could that would invest in the communications infrastructure. So basically what you need is the ability of your appliances, your heating system, your cooling system, your dishwashers, and your refrigerators to be able to talk to the utility. Today, they can't talk to the utility. The only conversation is through the on-off switch. So you have to actually build in that communication system. It doesn't mean new wires. It means a lot of devices, both at home and within the distribution system. Other investments will be made by private parties, as they are today. So today, companies like Exelon build new generating plants. They usually build centralized generating plants. But we also have companies that are now building wind farms and solar generation installations. So those companies would invest. But if we have renewable portfolio targets that are very high and strong and long-term, over 10, 15, 20 years, then they can look forward to investing with some confidence. They can build up the worker training. They can build up the production infrastructure. And I'm confident that we can get production of renewable energy devices, manufacturing of components, and so on here if we provide certainty to investors.
So what does that certainty mean? I mean, what does certainty mean?
Well, for instance, we have a target of a legislative mandate for developing 200 megawatts of offshore wind. The bill was passed a couple of years ago. 200 megawatts of offshore wind would be nice, but it isn't large enough for anybody to bring turbine manufacturing or blade manufacturing to Maryland. This kind of infrastructure already exists in Europe. We have practically no offshore wind and energy in this United States, just 5 turbines off Rhode Island. Europe already has an extensive infrastructure. They've been doing offshore wind since 1991, if you can believe that. We're a quarter of a century behind Europe. So you need to have targets of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 megawatts. We're going to need that. And say we are going to have this and allow the private developers then to go and develop, to stake out the land, to bid on the leases, and to be able to recover their investment. Now, offshore wind is getting cheaper, but it's not yet comparable to the other resources like onshore wind. Now, if we want the jobs in Maryland, then we have to be bold enough to set forth in that direction. If we want to import renewable energy from other states and export the jobs, we can do that too.
So you're talking not here about a public investment. You're talking about private investment.
Private investment, largely. Of course, it can be public investment, but private investment is how we do things. I mean, there are municipal utilities that are making this kind of investment. There is, for instance, CPS Energy, which is in Texas, owned by the city of San Antonio. And in the last few years, they've had a significant upheaval in this, away from fossil fuel and nuclear energy investments into efficiency and solar investments. And they are doing very well and providing excellent service to the people of San Antonio. In Maryland, we have, some city and cooperative utilities, but mainly we're privately owned. So I'm not assuming that that's going to change very soon.
So in what would it take politically and policy-wise to implement the things you're talking about? I mean, in other words, you'd have to even think about bringing industry here to create the infrastructure, but then self-building the infrastructure. What would you have to give to major companies to make them do that? I mean, you know what I'm saying? What would make that work? How would you convince a legislator that could work?
So we need a few things. We already have a pretty good order from the Public Service Commission for efficiency. We need to make sure that it's properly funded. There seems to be some reluctance that, the charge that we pay on our electricity bills for encouraging efficiency investment is somehow a tax. It is not. If you look at it in the form of electricity rates, what you pay per kilowatt hour, it looks like an added charge, but because it lowers the cost of the overall electricity system, how much new generation you need, and how much electricity you consume, it lowers bills overall. So we need to maintain and enhance our momentum on efficiency so we don't have to invest that much in generation. We need to clean up our definition of renewable energy, which is too lax, and restrict it to basically solar, wind, and geothermal energy. We need to set renewable portfolio standards on that basis. My recommendation for the year 2030 would be 55%. That way we can very robustly achieve the goal that the legislature set this year of 40% greenhouse gas reductions. If we do these things, I think we provide investment certainty to private investors, and they can go ahead and make the investments that will make it happen.
So what would could incentivize an Exelon to want to invest in that kind of wind energy or solar energy in the state of Maryland, given that they have this international portfolio, which is built around fossil fuels?
Yeah, well, you bring up a very important point, a political obstacle. So what has happened with Exelon in Illinois, for example, currently, and with nuclear corporations in New York, is they have successfully lobbied those two states to give them, in combination over the next decade or 12 years, about $10 billion in rebates and subsidies from ratepayers to keep aging, clunky nuclear power plants going that they say are not economical. We can't be doing things like that. Exelon obviously has an interest in extracting as much money from its existing generating resources. Unfortunately, Exelon also owns the distribution utilities, Pepco, BGE, in our state, and I opposed the merger of Exelon with Pepco Holdings exactly because I thought its influence would be too great. So the power of Exelon would not necessarily support what we are saying in terms of the ambition to achieve a fully renewable system, but we have to organize enough to overcome the corporate power if they do oppose it. If they support it and decide to change their tune, which has so far been very, very pro-nuclear and for getting added monies as needed from ratepayers, then all to the good. If not, then we have to make sure that that the political will is created through public pressure, because that's what you have to do, to chart that course. That's what I mean, that the main obstacle is not technology. The main obstacle is not economics. I calculated that by 2050 we would save maybe 15% compared to business as usual if we do renewable plus efficiency. But political gut, public organizing, and I think this would also benefit our economy and low-income households if we make energy cheaper. It would benefit manufacturing if we make energy cheaper.
So you mentioned something here. I want to come back to Exelon before we conclude, but and not Exelon, just about this whole how this will work and what that would mean to change the grid. But you just mentioned something I know you're working on, and curious how this would feed into it, since we cover this so much in our program, which is the question of low income communities and how this your policy work fits into that.
Yeah, Mark, the situation of low-income households in regard to energy costs is really very sad. It's not only energy costs, of course, it's housing costs also. At 50% of the median income, low-income households in Maryland pay fully 36% of their income just on energy bills. This means they're often faced with impossible choices. Do I pay my energy bill? Do I pay my rent? Do I buy food? Do I buy medicine? People become homeless as a result of these conflicts. When they become homeless, the costs of homelessness to the taxpayer, of course to the households themselves, but also to taxpayers, are very high. Costs of added emergency room visits are very high. So I did an extensive analysis of this. It's on our website. There's a whole book we did. I recommended, and many others also recommend, that energy burdens of low-income households be limited to 6% of gross income. And the benefits of reduced homelessness, reduced emergency visits, better productivity at work, better attendance at school would outweigh the added costs of assistance. We also need to make sure that low-income households can get access to solar energy and efficiency, much better than we're doing now.
So in the future conversations, I really want to explore in greater depth as well, just the economy in all of this, because that's the argument that is a pushback all the time. You know, the rebuilding of the grid, the investment in this infrastructure, what it would cost, and then how Hogan sees these things as a tax on industry. I mean, so a different way of thinking has to come about for this to be taken seriously.
Well, I don't think we have to think differently about economics, because the economics are there. 5 years ago, it was certainly true to say that solar energy is very expensive.
Right.
This is no longer true. You don't have to believe me. Look at what Lazard published last year, a Wall Street firm, about utility-scale solar and utility-scale wind. Both are cheaper than coal, both are cheaper than nuclear, and they are cheaper even than natural gas. And natural gas has price volatility, which produces its own risks and miseries. So I think the thinking that renewable energy and efficiency in combination will be more expensive than business as usual is completely obsolete.
I mean, so that to me, I mean, it's really critical what you're saying here, and how that becomes part of our mainstream conversation.
Yes, it's no longer
right?
alternative energy. It should be, the economics are there to make it mainstream energy. Our thinking hasn't changed.
So that's a big piece of this, it seems to me.
Is
how we create the public conversation to change the way we think, to show this is economically viable, which I think is the missing component.
Yeah, well, you and I can work together to make it so in Maryland.
Exactly.
You have the radio waves and I have the number information.
No, I think we'll do that. I mean, I think
that
this is very important, and I think, you know, we are leading up here to our Annapolis summit, which I'll tell folks about in a minute, and that is the kind of things we have to really kind of push with our political leaders, and I think that's a really important thing for us to do.
And before you leave me, Mark, you know, we have wonderful political leaders in our state. We have, you know, enacted the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act, which is very good. Even this year, it was extended and made more ambitious for 2030. So it's not that it can't be done. The current administration has reaffirmed this year that we have a science-based approach to climate protection, unlike, you know, a lot of noises that are being made on the national stage. So I actually asked Secretary Grumbles recently in a public forum where you were present whether he would not use his good offices with the governor and with other governors on a bipartisan basis to approach the incoming Trump administration to persuade them to think more realistically and practically about climate and energy economics. But the situation on the ground in that regard doesn't look very promising, so it would take quite a lot of persuading, I think.
Well, we're just beginning. Dr. Arjan Makhijani has been with us here. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. We look forward to having him on a great deal more in the coming year to really press and push these ideas, especially over the coming months in our legislative session. And Arjan, once again, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Likewise.
And folks, I want to take this opportunity to remind you to join me on Wednesday, January the 11th for the 14th Annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Calvert House in Annapolis, Maryland. It's your chance to be heard and have your questions answered by Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. To do join us, you can get tickets by calling Haley Poling at 443-524-8161. Again, tickets, 443-524-8161, or you can email Haley Poling at hpoling, that's H-P-O-L-I-N-G, at thedailyrecord.com. So do join us. It's always a great event. It opens the Annapolis session. You'll be with us from 7:30 in the morning to 10 in the morning, and it's an event you do not want to miss. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by The Daily Record, The Mark Steiner Show, Stevenson University, Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, Maryland State Education Association, Alexander and Cleaver, VPC, and WEAA. Thank you all for listening today, folks, and being with us. It's always great to have you as part of this show. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Mark Henry. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. And let me welcome our new production intern and production assistant, Nadia Romlikin. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.